I say to people that Hawaiian is an easy language to learn, but it's a really difficult language to learn well.
How did a restless young man from Minnesota become one of Hawaii's leading Hawaiian language scholars? Next on Long Story Short, the remarkable journey of former post office worker Marvin Noglemeyer, now Dr. Puakea Noglemeyer.
Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox, produced with Sony Technology, is Hawaii's first weekly television program produced and broadcast in HD. High definition, it's in Sony's DNA.
Aloha mai kakou. I'm Leslie Wilcox. In this edition of Long Story Short, Puakea Noglemeyer, Hawaiian language advocate and teacher at the Manoa campus of the University of Hawaii for more than a quarter of a century. He was Marvin Noglemeyer when he landed in the islands on an adventure. He didn't mean to stick around. Hawaii was supposed to be just a stopover on the way to Japan. But this is where he stayed. And it's where the young man in his early 20s was singled out by one of Hawaii's most respected hula masters.
Well, the name was given to me by Maiki Aiu Lake, and it was her name. And it blindsided me, and I didn't understand it. I was in hula with one of her students from the first graduating class, Millie Allen, out in Waianae. Maiki used to borrow us, but we didn't like really know her. I mean, she was the mother, you know, I mean, she was the head of it all. So she'd borrow the men dancers especially. So we had performed for her. There was a thank you luau afterwards, and she's the one talking. So we have to wait until Maiki finishes, and she's thanking seemingly everyone in the Honolulu phone book. And then she launched in going, talking about this, the man with the spear, and I want you to meet the man with the spear. Well, we had done a hula ihe, it was done with a spear in hand. And so she starts going, so I want you to all meet Puakea. Puakea, stand up and show them who you are. Now I'm three or four rows back. So I kind of, you know, and she keeps pointing right to me and going, stand up, you know, I want them to. This is Puakea, and I'm still not standing up. And my hula brothers and sisters are going, Marvin, I think she's talking to you. So I stand up, one of these, you know you're the wrong guy. Or it occurred to me, maybe she's got me confused with someone else. So I'm blushing to the roots of my hair. And she goes on real naturally, this is Puakea, and he's out in Waianae, and he's dancing with Mili. So I sit down totally befuddled, and we go to leave. And we're going to ask about, by the way, I'm Marvin. And across the way, she goes, that was my name when I entered the hula, and now it's your name.
What an honor.
It's an honor, and it's part of her method, because then we all get in the car, and my kumu now is left to explain all that. So I'm thinking, it can't be my name. I was born Marvin. I know. And so Mili explained that that's a really heady thing to gift a name and to gift her own name. And so from now on, that's it. So in Halau is where it started. I was always referred to as Puakea. It signifies, fair child in effect. So I was the pale one in our line. That works. She never really explained why that name or why she gave me her name. She just said, I expect you to do good things.
The fair child born as Marvin Noglemeyer spent his early years moving with his family throughout California and Nebraska, finally settling in Minnesota when he was 7. 1 year after high school and during a particularly vicious winter, he was persuaded by friends to quit his job at the post office and head off on an adventure to Japan with a brief stop in Honolulu.
Lost my wallet in the San Diego airport. So we had driven cross country, gone to San Diego. We had an airline ticket to as far as Honolulu. I would pick up passport here. I don't even have a license. I don't have a birth certificate, no money, really. I had my plane ticket. Came to Honolulu, had to call and say, okay, big adventurer, already blew it, lost my wallet. Mom.
Send money.
Mom, get me a birth certificate. Well, money came first. Birth certificate took probably a month. By the time the birth certificate came, it just seemed there was no rush to get to Japan. So put that off and put that off.
What did you decide to stay? I mean, What happened in that month?
Oh, from the airport, we ended up going out. We stayed at Makua Beach.
This How did you find your way to Makua Beach from the airport?
The two kids I'm traveling with actually knew people here. There was a Minnesota house at Makua Beach. A lot of that was Vietnam War folks, you know, guys who had come back. They weren't ready to go back to the, you know, States. And a whole bunch of folks ended up out there. So we end up in this handmade little, you know, Nara's in Makua Beach. I lived there for 3 months. Maybe the nicest 3 months of my life, really. Just blissful ignorance. I didn't read a newspaper. I didn't think about anything, just wandered along, enjoyed water, enjoyed sand. And I guess they would have thought of this as homeless, although it's really the most organized homeless I'd ever seen. You know, there were, you know, full houses, fully equipped. These are...
And this is right on the edge of the beach?
Right on the edge of the sand, up against the kiawe trees and the halikoa. And, I mean, it was really a remarkable place. There were probably 50 people. The Minnesota Hooch had two bedrooms, you know, two, like, formal, and a bunk bed. I mean, made out of plywood, made out of leftovers that were found all over the place. Kept very tidy, actually. Full kitchen set up, dishes, everything. It's not exactly the way the homeless are running today. It did fall into decline by the late 70s. They were doing cleanups of, and should have. It had gotten pretty, just did a lot of rubbish. But it was actually a tidy, nice place to be. The beach was pristine. Chilled there for 3 months. I actually got an infection on my foot and had to go to the hospital. They would not let me out of the hospital if I didn't have a residence. So I ended up moving into Makaha. Moved in with friends in Makaha.
Puakea Noglemeyer confesses that his first means of support in Hawaii was living off his unemployment checks. Then he linked up with a community of artists in Waianae and became a goldsmith.
Oh, that was my career. That was something I could do for the rest of my life. And I've not done it now for 30 years. But who would have thought? One of my co-craftspersons was Mililani Allen, who became my kumuhula. She did beautiful silk batik with Hawaiian motifs and just beautiful things. But one day she was talking about, well, I'm teaching hula. We didn't know she taught hula. I want to open a men's class, but guys are so gun shy, you know, they won't take it. And so we pretty much said, we should open your class. We'll take your class. Would you? Okay. So now we're all committed. So her class of men started up with all these, a motley crew of craftspeople. They were not dancers.
What was the name of the halau?
Halau Hula Umililani, which that was her name. She had been teaching maybe 2 years. She had graduated from Maiki Aiulei. She'd been teaching women. It's very, you know, formal halau structure. Classes run for an hour once a week, et cetera, et cetera. So she opens the men's class. You know, we're all dummies. You know, we don't know anything. I didn't know any Hawaiian history. I didn't know Hawaii had a kingdom or kings, or I didn't even know they had a language. You know, I came as an empty calabash. So, and I'd been here for a while, but I learned Waianae stuff, not necessarily Hawaii stuff. So we step into class, and it's just a doorway to a whole new world I didn't know was there. So while all the girls' classes were an hour a week, the guys' classes, we'd start at 6, we'd go till midnight. Because we were so intrigued and we were so empty and so engaged. The halau became a social center for us. So
you were doing more than dance, you were doing language?
Well, we were doing dance. And with dance, in the Maiki School of Dance, you have to do research, and you have to do attempt translation, and you have to write notes for all your dances. You have to keep notebooks. There's quizzes. It's like an academy of dance, right? So we did that. So I started to learn language just sort of randomly. Then we started to learn chant. There was a project in 1975, 76, maybe, called the Mele Project. And Keahi Allen and what was the board she was on, they felt that chanting was going to go away because the only ones who knew it were elders and nobody was teaching it. It wasn't seen. So they set up to have Edith Kanaka'ole and Edith McKenzie teach chanting to to young people, to, you know, people that are involved in halal. I end up in a class. That's fascinating stuff. The chants, they come from everywhere. Some of them are really ancient, some of them are more recent. That's what led me into language. And there's an epiphany that happens because I have a good short-term memory. So I could look at a chant and memorize it. And under pressure, I could keep that for a while, you know, so we could memorize these things. I'd have to memorize the Hawaiian and then memorize the English to make sense out of it and get these. The payback for these classes was we had to do presentations. You had to go out to schools and whatnot, make it a living practice kind of thing. So we did a presentation, and it might have been at McKinley, I don't remember. This old gentleman walks up to me and talks to me in Hawaiian. And I was stunned. I said, oh, sorry, Uncle, I don't speak Hawaiian. And he looked a little crestfallen, and he, you know, he said, well, but how can you understand what you're chanting? I said, well, I memorized the English. And it sounded dumb. You know, it still sounds a little dumb. And he says, but how can you tell how well you did?
How can you tell how well you did?
Yeah, this is, you know.
Who was this man?
Well, and I didn't know who he was, and now he walks away, and I thought, you're right, you know. And then I thought, right there, I just thought, you're right. Why would I engage if I'm not trying to learn what this is about? So then I started to try and learn Hawaiian language. Now, it's probably 10 years later that I realized who that old man is. It's Auntie Edith's husband, Luca. He's a tall, handsome man. And, you know, I was so blown and intimidated, I never even asked, who are you? You know, we went back to Auntie Edith McKenzie, who was running our class with. Auntie Edith Kanaka'ole would come teach us, but Auntie Edith was the main run. So we want to learn some language. Well, she was a student herself, really. She wasn't a native speaker. Her mother spoke it, and her grandmother, so she had a good handle, but she'd gone to classes. But she says, well, I'll teach you what I know. So we started with a class on her back porch.
That back porch class would lead him to another home-style learning experience with an elderly man born in 1891, a cultural expert and noted photographer who had taken pictures at the funeral of Queen Liliʻuokalani. His name was Theodore Kelsey. Young Puakea was introduced by Mr. Kelsey's caretaker, the writer-historian June Gutmanis.
She researched Hawaiian stuff, and she'd written a number of books, Na Pule Kahiko, Kahuna La'au Lapa'au. She would assemble Hawaiian language material. And she could do that because she had this old gentleman living with her. He was 88, I think, when I met him. And he was fluent in Hawaiian. And he would help translate. You know, he would translate all her things, and then she'd make sense out of it. So when I met him, and I asked him, would you be able to teach Hawaiian? And he said, no. He said, I'm not a teacher. He says, there's some books on that. But with what Auntie Edith was doing, see, I'm a highly motivated being character. If I want something, I'll usually, you know, figure out a way to try and make that happen. So I would take what Auntie Edith was teaching us, which was pretty simple Hawaiian, and I would talk to him when I went up to visit, and he'd talk back in Hawaiian. He wouldn't teach me Hawaiian, but he'd engage. So, and my Hawaiian was atrocious.
So you must have gotten to some dead ends in the conversation.
Oh, dead ends, a lot of dead ends, yeah. Or misunderstandings, because I would say, of course, what I thought meant A, and he would understand it very clearly for what I'd really said, which was B. So he'd respond to B, and I'm still in A.
Was he able to correct you? Did he do that?
It started off so slow. I took to going up 3 days a week. I would be there at the, and he welcomed that, and June welcomed that. It was sort of an interesting triangle there. June would give him things to translate. He was born in 1891, so he had a whole different set of ethics. He would not translate anything for her that was sexual or inappropriate for a lady. She'd always tell him, I'm no lady, you know? But he'd just say, oh, I can't understand this. So she would give me things that he had sent back to her saying, I can't interpret this, and he'd interpret it for me.
Oh, I see. So you're the guy.
Yeah, so this became an interesting little triangle. So in the course of this, he would correct me the next visit. Way too gentle. So let's say that instead of saying Wai'anae, I say Wai'anae. So the next visit will be in the middle of something, he'll go, oh, and iku'umana'o, Wai'anae k'pololei. You know, oh, by the way, I think that Wai'anae is probably correct. Correct for what? You know, and it took a while for me to recognize that he's actually dealing with something that I misunderstood, missaid, mistranslated, something from the last visit.
And that's his way of being gentle and polite and old school.
In the course of a few years, and it took a few years, he would correct me as I said it. Big, progress. So then it became, you know, more workable. The other thing is he was going deaf rapidly in English and not in Hawaiian.
How does that happen?
You know, and it sounds like June was insistent. It's just because he likes Hawaiian. You know, it has nothing to do with it. Actually, we've run into a lot of elders who can hear in Hawaiian and cannot hear in English. The structure of the language is different enough. Hawaiian is very projectile in its way. Every word ends in a vowel. So every word exits. And a lot of English words don't.
You swallow the syllable.
And the end word is a consonant. Like a word like consonant. You know, it all goes in. So just too much of it is unheard. And Hawaiian, every single word ends in a vowel. Every syllable ends in a vowel. So it's actually a lot more hearable. Also, the low resonant voice goes in a way that, you know, upper range wouldn't go. And even in Hawaiian, he could only hear a male voice. June would get real frustrated because he just was so deaf to her tone. So she'd come to the table and say, you know, do you want more eggs? At first he wouldn't hear anything, and when finally she'd tap, you know, he'd have to look, and she'd end up shouting, you want eggs? You want eggs? My leg? You want, what do you want? And then if I just turned and said, Ihua moho now. Oh, no, I'm fine. You know, he'd answer. And it'd be so frustrating for her, you know. But that's the level and the language.
Sounds like you're making progress then. You're learning Hawaiian.
By then we were rolling. Once it started, I mean, I was so fascinated.
And were you learning more than basic words? Were you learning, did he actually explain nuances, or were you able to tell nuances from how he spoke to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny. He's born, you know, I don't know what, 70 years before? He's born in 1891. So we don't even exist in the same worlds. He's the oldest living human I'd ever met. So what do you talk about? We kind of just jumped off the cliff and went into deep water. Later on, I had to learn stuff that made that make sense. We would go, mostly the things that June was trying to get translated were either chants or articles that were really kind of dense articles about opinion pieces in the newspapers. So we're working on language that's way over my head. And he'd walk through and go, well, this is this, and this is why, and this is, but not doing grammar, doing like, phrasing. And why this would be said here, and what this place name really means. So if it shows up in this chant, it's this. Well, this is stuff my little fragile head really wasn't ready to get a hold of yet. So we're playing there. That's why I went to university. So I go into UH. Now I'm going to be an academic. And I launched in taking Hawaiian language as fast as I could. Thank goodness, Noi Losh, who you might know, was my teacher, and she knew what I was doing already, so she let me take 101 and 201 at the same time, and let me miss 2 days a week because I went to see Mr. Kelsey on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So she let that go. So I showed up 3 days a week and did class, and that made sense out of the pieces because I could always bring something interesting back. And she'd, of a Monday, she'd go, well, if you see Mr. Kelsey tomorrow, ask him about this.
It's experiential learning, so that fits.
It made it so usable. Because I wasn't in school I didn't even necessarily want a degree. I was in school because they had the toys.
You were continuing to do your metal work, your craft work.
Yeah. Actually, I start to step away from that about the time I launch into school. I'm doing it part-time now. I'm doing it special, you know, for a special event or something. And then we step away from it. That's about the time I step away.
That's when you decided this is where I'm turning my body?
Well, and I make money, you know, I'm a student aide at school, or I got paid for where I lived. I was a caretaker for a house on the beach in Waianae. So they paid me to live in this house and go to the beach. It was a nice life. So that pretty much covered expenses, and then school paid for itself. I got a scholarship to go to school, just enough to cover tuition. Tuition at Leeward Community College wasn't real intimidating then. It was $40 a semester.
Is that right, $40?
I think that was it for full time.
Had you learned any languages before this?
I learned Spanish badly when I was in high school.
And did you have an ear for language? You must have.
People say that I do, and I think, then why did I have to work so hard at it?
At what, at Hawaiian
at
as well?
At learning at any language, yeah. I'd have to like go over vocab lists and talk to myself. And, you know, it's if I really had an ear for it, I would think you'd just kind of fall in. But so I think maybe I have a little ear, but not a whole lot of ear.
And you're willing to work at it.
That's a big piece. I'm willing to work. And I will, you know, I used to ride the bus back and forth to Waianae, and I'd be muttering to myself the whole way because I'm using a new pattern that we just covered in class. And I'll just, you know, oh, that lady is doing this. That guy is doing this. You know, they are doing this. I'd just run the pattern through in my head to kind of familiarize it, normalize it. So I think if I was a whiz, it would have happened. Like you wake up and you're just good at it. I don't know.
Do you think Hawaiian is different from other languages to learn? Some people say, oh, it's a simple language. It only has, what is it, 12 letters or 13?
13 with 13. The Okina.
But of course, it's a very dense and rich language. But I'm not sure, since I don't speak it fluently, how and why. There's a lot of layers of meaning, and how does that work?
Yeah, I say to people that Hawaiian is an easy language to learn, but it's a really difficult language to learn well. Mm. But there's an entry level to language.
Because
that
it's a logical language, right? Unlike English, which is not terribly logical.
It follows its rules much better than English does, and it doesn't conjugate verbs. And so there's a lot of just the structural part of the language makes it easier access. But, oh, then you get into multiple meanings and you get into, you know, just juxtaposition that allows things to happen in language that I don't think is nearly as common in English. It certainly wasn't in Spanish. Spanish to me was more mechanical.
How do you understand the multiple meanings if you're away from the context in which the language was formed?
Some of them, I think, are probably beyond full grasp without some of those original contexts. You know, so you can read texts that were written in a time and with reference to things that just is impossible to get your head around today. So you might be able to get some inkling, but you're not going to get the details of it. When we translated the Hi'iaka from Hawaiian into English, now that's 500 pages of text, and it goes everywhere. The narrator and the author are both having fun. It's basically the same guy, but it's, you know, officially the narrator is having fun in the telling of the story because he injects himself all the time. But the author then, all the way through the story, is doing little plays and choices of words and just, you know, this. So Sahoa Fukushima, who was the collaborator on this, he and Kamali Kuwata, he turned at one point, we were done, I think. And he says, how much of this do you think we really got? Now, we had translated it, we had edited that translation, we'd been on it for a year, year and a half on this one text.
And you pointed out different things in your text about how, you know, this is what some people say, but this is what you think. And you really did a lot of interpretive work on that, and that you explained to the reader.
We really tried to minimize that in the book itself. But a whole lot of that happened in the processing. While we were doing this, there was so much dialogue on, look at this, look at how this is working, look at, you know. And so he says, how much of this do you really think we got? And we sat down and we were trying to imagine. I said, if we're really lucky, 60%, maybe. Wow. What do you think? That there might be that much more of the humor and the sarcasm and maybe cynicism and other pieces that they're there. And we might have caught some flavor. We know something's there, but.
And it had so many human emotions and values in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Epic.
Yeah, and a great challenge. But you're right, there's some of it that I think is simply sort of beyond grasp in some ways. You keep trying, keep reaching, you know, that's. I'm a better student today than I was.
Because?
So, I'm older and I'm more entertained. I think, you know, I get more out of the interaction. How's that?
If Puakea Nogelmeyer's voice sounds familiar to you, perhaps you've heard it, taking the bus on Oahu. It's his voice announcing the street names at all of the stops. In 2009, Puakea is busy working with collaborators on a groundbreaking online Hawaiian language project to make accessible 19th and 20th century newspaper articles. These represent an archive of largely untapped resources rich in cultural knowledge and history. The online project is called Ho'olaupa'i, which means to generate abundance, and you can find it at nupepa.org. Among other projects he's worked on, a 500-page text that represents the first English translation of the epic tale of Hi'iaka Ikapoliopele. And Puakea Nogelmeyer continues to share the Hawaiian language, teaching others, as he was taught long ago as a young malihini. Until next time, for Long Story Short on PBS Hawaii, I'm Leslie Wilcox. Ahui ho kākou.
Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox is produced in HD by PBS Hawaii with Sony Technology. High definition, it's in Sony's DNA.
Mr. Kelsey had become kind of a pivotal part of my life. He was like a window on another world. You know, he was an adult photographer at the funeral of Lili'u Okalani. It was actually the funeral of Lili'u that made him think the things I love most are going away. He made a promise to spend the rest of his life documenting. Well, he didn't know he'd do it for the next 70 years, you know? He lived to be 96.
Did you see his documentations, his journals?
His material at the archives is like 7-8 feet of paper. So he really did spend the rest of his life writing things down.
So he became widely recognized for his...
He didn't publish hardly anything. He was actually part of a group that was outside of the Bishop Museum, but documenting Hawaiian culture.